Call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order, 8:09, Friday, April 16th. Members present are Representatives Shragi, McCarty, Fields, Nelson, and Snyder. Please silence your cell phone. Thanks to our Secretary Leah Frazier and our moderator Marissa Truitt. Today on the agenda, we have second hearing for Senate Bill 87, second hearing for House Bill 145, second hearing for House Bill 149, first hearing for House Bill 125, and we'll also forward the appointees' names who we heard from on Wednesday. First up is Senate Bill 87, a governor's bill on reinsurance. This is the second hearing of the bill in House Labor and Commerce. Ms. Wingheyer, do you have additional remarks for the committee? Do members of the committee have questions for Ms. Wingheyer? Seeing none, I'm going to turn to Representative McCarty, do we have a motion to move Senate Bill 87?
I make a motion to move Senate Bill 87. Let's see, this is motion to move Senate Bill 87, version 32-GS1584/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there objections? Seeing none, House Bill or Senate Bill 87 passes from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign paperwork. Next up, we'll have House Bill 145, Representative Snyder's bill on pharmacist authority. House Labor and Commerce. Next up is House Bill 145 on pharmacist authority. This is the second hearing of the bill on House Labor and Commerce. Representative Snyder and Ms. Aliana Salanguit, do you have any additional remarks or do committee members have questions?
Just a couple brief remarks, partially in response to the first hearing's conversation. Quick reminder, with this bill, we're basically looking to make sure we're well defining the patient care services that pharmacists can provide. It was highlighted in particular during the pandemic, the importance of those services, and this will help make sure that We specify them, the board can regulate them, we can continue those services, and it also contains a component making sure that they can be reimbursed for the services they provide by insurance providers. We do have on the phone today Dr. Ruffridge from the Board of Pharmacy. We have Dr. Wadsworth again from the UAA Pharmacy Program. We also have Sandin Fisher from Ledge Legal. I appreciate Representative Kaufman is not here this morning, but he did raise a good question about the term general health and wellness as being something that pharmacists can support. And we, in response to that inquiry, we did pose that back to our pharmacists and also Ledge Legal so they can address that.
Questions from committee members? Seeing none, I'm going to open public testimony. We have a lot of people to testify, so if you could keep your remarks to 2 minutes, then I'm sure we can get through all the public testimony. First up, Angela Jaglowitz. Ms. Jaglowitz, please proceed. And Representative Kaufman is present at 8:15.
Hello, my name is Angela Jaglowitz, and I am from Anchorage. I'm a practicing primary care pharmacist and certified diabetes education specialist at a federally qualified health center. I support passage of House Bill 145. At my practice site, I'm an integrated part of the healthcare team, meaning I work directly with primary care providers and caring for patients with chronic diseases such as diabetes. My role as part of the team is to ensure medications contribute to the best possible health outcomes for the patient, which I'm able to achieve by providing care through an ongoing patient-pharmacist relationship via follow-up visits. The care I provide is easily accessed and through the time I devote to my patients, improves the continuity of their care. This service is invaluable to primary care providers as I help their patients achieve therapeutic goals while also freeing up their busy schedules to provide healthcare services to more patients. My patients also greatly benefit from my close relationships with them. Through my ongoing visits, my patients develop the knowledge, skill, and confidence needed to manage their own health and healthcare. This in turn promotes patient satisfaction. In fact, just last week, a patient voiced to his primary care provider that through his visits with me, he was able to better understand his disease, diabetes, and meet his personal and therapeutic goals. It is my hope for pharmacists to provide these invaluable patient care services to Alaskans for many years to come. Passage of House Bill 145 will help make this possible. Thank you for recognizing the importance of House Bill 145. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next up, Dan Nelson. Mr. Nelson, please proceed.
Hi, my name is Dan Nelson. I'm calling from Fairbanks. I'm the director of pharmacy at Tannen on Cheese Conference, the native clinic up here in Fairbanks, and serving basically a large chunk of the interior of Alaska. The COVID-19 pandemic has required an all-hands-on-deck situation for Alaska healthcare professionals, and pharmacists are one of the most accessible healthcare professionals and have rapidly responded to Alaska's healthcare needs in both urban and underserved communities. I'd just like to urge your support for House Bill 145. I believe this is a very important bill that that helps continue some of the services that we're able to provide. I don't want to spend a lot of time. I know there's a lot of people that are calling in, but I do think that this legislation makes a lot of sense, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about how I feel like this could potentially help better serve the rural patients of Alaska. So thank you again for hearing me on this and for your support of House Bill 145.
Thanks, Mr. Nelson. Next up, Jay Flynn from the Norton Sound region. Mr. Flynn, please proceed.
Hello, my name's Jay Flynn. I'm actually a physician in the Norton Sound region. I'm trained in internal medicine and pediatrics. I am calling in support of House Bill 145. I have worked extremely closely with the pharmacists in the Norton Sound region to provide literally thousands of vaccines improvement every year to the people in Norton Sound, including Nome and then also the surrounding villages. I want to point, I guess, to sections 4, 5, and 6 and section 7 specifically of the bill in talking about vaccine administration and being able to oversee technicians. We are still not able to get to all of our patients, specifically our pediatric patients, to deliver life-saving vaccines. This was even pre-COVID. and this has obviously been ramped up in the face of the pandemic. Without their help that we've done right now, we wouldn't be able to get to half as many patients as we've been able to. And I feel like their contribution it allows us to have more impact in our region as a whole. So I just wanted to voice my support for House Bill 145. And if anybody has any questions, I can answer them at this time.
Thanks, Dr. Flynn. Next up is Kylie Goff from Nome.
Hi, I'm work with Dr. Flynn, and then I have actually remarks. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak. I have remarks from another provider to present, from Dr. Kyle Pohl. He is speaking on himself by working at Norton Sound. He wants to say that he has had the pleasure of providing a full spectrum of internal medicine and pediatric care throughout Alaska for the past 5 years, and had the opportunity of working in Anchorage as well as in Nome and the surrounding villages of Norton Sound. And one theme that has remained constant throughout all these locations that he could not have been as effective without the outstanding work of the pharmacists. He wants to take the opportunity to thank all of the pharmacists that he has worked with throughout the state, and he feels that they are all highly trained and that their contributions would not have been as effective without their contributions. Our work in rural Alaska has relied heavily on the skills of pharmacists. Our pediatric well child and immunization campaign was the result of the combined efforts of physicians and pharmacists. The entire initiative was spearheaded by pharmacists, and they have been leaders in organizing and planning and executing the effort. Through this campaign, we have drastically increased the number of children who are up to date on immunizations and who have been in to see the provider for the well check. Additionally, these pharmacists have been able to create chronic care registries for the complex adult population. Each step of the way, we have worked closely with pharmacists, and our pharmacists are highly qualified healthcare professionals who have been able to provide critical access to healthcare, particularly in rural areas where there is a shortage of primary care providers. This is felt more substantially. Thank you so much for hearing, and if you have any questions, feel free to let me know.
Thanks, Ms. Goff. Next up is Barry Christensen. Mr. Christensen, you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is Barry Christensen. I am a community pharmacist in Ketchikan. My family and I have operated an independent pharmacy in Ketchikan since it was founded by my father over 47 years ago. As such, I'm a second-generation pharmacist, and I also consider myself fortunate as two of my daughters have also chosen the profession for their career. For the record, I am also co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Alaska Pharmacists Association. I would like to thank Representative Snyder for introducing House Bill 145 and the committee for hearing this bill today. I'm asking for your support in passing this important piece of legislation. Pharmacy has changed in many ways since my father started our pharmacy in 1974. This bill recognizes that the changes have taken place and that today's pharmacists are truly in a better position to help patients meet their pharmaceutical needs. In order for community pharmacies such as ours to survive and serve our patients, we need the statutory language present in this bill. I'll keep my comments brief as I know there are others online to testify. Thank you again. I urge your support for this legislation.
Thanks, Mr. Christensen. Next up, Tom Wadsworth from Wasilla. Mr. Wadsworth, please proceed. We can return to the testifier. Natalie McKay, if you're online, please proceed with your testimony.
Hi, yes, thank you. My name is Natalie McKay, and I'm a certified pharmacy technician at Petersburg Rexall Drug in Petersburg, Alaska. I want to thank you all for your time and for recognizing the importance of HB 145. This bill is especially important to rural and underserved areas, such as our island here in Petersburg, Oftentimes, our pharmacists are the first stop when patients have questions or are seeking care. Allowing pharmacists and support staff to provide certain healthcare services will also help increase access for these patients, especially in areas like Petersburg where it can be limited. Also, allowing pharmacists to oversee technician duties will give them more freedom and ability to perform their tasks in the pharmacy. I again want to thank you for your time and recognize the importance of HB 145, and I hope that we have your support. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. McKay. Next up, Douglas Bartow from Palmer. Mr. Bartko, please proceed.
Yes, I'm Doug Bartko. I'm calling from Palmer, and I had a small office pharmacy in Wasilla, TKO Pharmacy, from the early 90s until 2008. I graduated from the University of Washington School of Pharmacy, and when I graduated, the Doctor of Pharmacy, or the PharmD, was optional, but now all pharmacists are required to take the extra training and graduate with a PharmD. And I support HB 145. When I started my practice, billing was all on paper, and then we switched to the digital computer systems that we have now. And one of the problems that I ran into was rejection of claims. And it was very time-consuming to correct the claim problem. And the last part of HB 145 addresses the problem of all the healthcare professions. Pharmacists, for some reason, do not have provider status, and they need to be paid like any other healthcare profession for the services they provide based on their training. And so hopefully we can get all our legislators to support HB 145, and basically some of the statutes that we now have are too old, and they just need to be updated. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartko. Next up in public testimony, we have Justin Ruffridge from Soldotna. Mr. Ruffridge, please proceed.
Thank you, House Labor and Commerce Committee members. My name is Justin Ruffridge. I am a pharmacist in the City of Soldotna with Soldotna Professional Pharmacy. I also have Juno Drug Company and a remote pharmacy in Girdwood. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Board of Pharmacy today, and although I gave testimony and answered questions at our last hearing, I just wanted to reiterate that we support House Bill 145. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mr. Ruffridge. Mark Borer, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you and good morning. My name is Mark Borer. I live in Chugach, Alaska. I've been a licensed pharmacist in Alaska since 1991. I work for Fred Meyer. My current position is titled Pharmacy Practice Coordinator, which translates to I'm the supervisor of all the Fred Meyer pharmacy locations in the state of Alaska. I appreciate and thank you for recognizing the importance of House Bill 145 and for allowing for me to have a moment to comment. I will definitely try to be brief. I have practiced pharmacy in our state for 31 years, performing all duties related to that role. In the last year, we have really stepped up our game. We provided free COVID testing in Eagle River from May to June, partnered with Fairbanks Public Health to provide free testing at the Carlson Center from July through October. We've offered COVID antibody testing starting in November. We fully enrolled in the state COVID vaccine program and gave our first dose on December 22nd. We quickly increased to include every location in the state. We've been providing vaccines for many years. Without some of the Health and Social Services or HHS, U.S. HHS, we would not have been able to do some of those things quite so easily. In closing, I really urge you to support House Bill 145, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up is Dirk White from Sitka. Mr. White, please proceed.
Hi, yes, good morning. This is Dirk White. I'm a pharmacist in Sitka, Alaska with my wife, Trish. She's a pharmacist as well. We have two locations in Sitka, Harry Race Pharmacy and White's Pharmacy. We also offer durable medical, home health care, hospital beds, and all those sorts of items. And in doing so, we have 35 employees here in Sitka. And as Barry, I also have a son who is following and will be hopefully be able to take over the business from us. And the practice has been kind of mentioned, a pharmacy in the past. We've been operating for 35 years now. It has changed substantially from when I graduated. And as I was vaccinating one of the nurses here in town, I looked at her and I said, I imagine you probably never expected to have your pharmacist give you a vaccination. And after this testimony, I will be going to our vaccination clinic that is going on today. It's just one of the many, many new practice options that need to be outlined and delineated for the Board of Pharmacy and our profession to evolve into the new century and continue to offer better and more consistent healthcare options for our patients. Being a community pharmacy, we have hours that are nonspecific. We get phone calls to do things in the middle of the night. We've gone in, and one of the things that we're doing starting up now is strep test, RSV, and we've been doing COVID tests as well. And so those are the sorts of things that we've been able to offer to our patients. And we've, unfortunately, since we're not considered medical providers, we are not able to bill insurance companies. So we've had to ask patients to pay us cash, which in some cases is a hardship, and we've still provided that service because it's necessary. And we will continue to evolve. And with that, with House Bill passage of House Bill 145, that will allow us to improve the profession and increase access to health care to all of our communities and the citizens in the state. I urge you to support and pass this out of this committee, and we can get moving forward to the new future. And I appreciate your time and listening to us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. White. Next up is Talithia Bogart from Anchorage. Please proceed.
Hi, my name is Talithia Bogart, and I'm a student of pharmacy in my third year at the Joint Doctor of Pharmacy program at UAA in Idaho State, and I support the passage of House Bill 145. Before pharmacy school, I got a bachelor's in biology, and I was a high school science teacher for 7 years. And before that, I was a pharmacy technician for 7 years. So I've pretty much been involved in science and healthcare for all of my adult life. I understand that Alaska is no stranger to shortages in healthcare services, and I believe House Bill 145 will in part help alleviate some of those issues, especially in community and primary care settings. As a pharmacy student, I'm being prepared to handle a variety of practice settings and specialties, things that include primary care, critical care, emergency medicine, community pharmacy, and many others. And even though I might be viewed as just a student, I've already seen firsthand the impact of my training. I have traveled with other healthcare providers, such as nurses, social workers, NPs, all across the state to places like Chinega Bay, to Titlick, Valdez, Hudikal, and even some places that were less remote, like Soldotna and Juneau. And traveling to these places, I was able to provide point-of-care testing, education, and then immunizations to both adults and children. I've also participated in a number of COVID vaccination clinics and administered hundreds of vaccines. Several elders I vaccinated were just in tears because they were so thankful to receive the COVID vaccine that I was able to help provide, because it provided them a glimmer of hope for the first time in a long time. They just felt like they were one step closer to getting to hug their grandchildren or get back to normal. So, and people at these COVID vaccination clinics had a lot of questions and sometimes misinformation regarding the virus and the vaccine. And due to my education and training, I was able to address those things. So pharmacists are important members of the healthcare team, and working together with nurses, nurse practitioners, and physicians, I believe we can greatly improve the patient's healthcare experience.
Thanks, Ms. Bogart.
Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Next up is Jacob Jordan from Anchorage.
Good morning. My name is Jacob Jordan, and I'm from Anchorage. I'm also a pharmacy student in my third year at the Joint Doctor of Pharmacy program at the University of Alaska Anchorage and Idaho State University. I'm testifying this morning to voice my support for passage of House Bill 145, and I'm asking you to support it as well. Before attending pharmacy school, I graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point and spent 9 years active duty with service in Germany, Afghanistan, and finally here in Alaska. While I was stationed here, I fell in love with the state and I ended my term of service, and I resolved to become a pharmacist so that I could continue my service to Alaska, only in another capacity. But like anything worthwhile, it takes an intense training regimen to become proficient, and pharmacy is no exception. This training includes 4 years of focused education on medication use, safety, and monitoring, with a focus on chronic disease management, health and wellness support, and providing preventive health services within the community. I'm required to complete over 2,000 hours of hands-on clinical experience, which started before my first day of class and is culminating now in full-time clinical training during my fourth year of the program. On top of this, there are 3 years of didactic or classroom-based training that I must complete as well. However, through this training, our focus remains on providing care to patients in need. To this end, students within the program have undertaken independent health initiatives to improve health care in the state of Alaska. Personally, I've utilized my previous military training and experience to coordinate, support, and grow a community outreach program focused on increasing access to preventive health services. One such initiative is the Alaska Assisted Living Home Immunization Program, an event that meets people where they're at in their homes, utilizing mobile vaccination teams to meet this underserved medical population. This program also brings together over 60 volunteers each year from multiple medical disciplines and organizations to provide these services at no charge. Finally, passage of House Bill 145 helps modernize Alaska's Pharmacy Practice Act and will resolve longstanding regulatory issues that will allow more patients access to pharmacist healthcare services, which I think I've shown that we are well-trained. I appreciate your time today to listen to my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Margaret Soden from Fairbanks. Ms. Soden, please proceed.
Hi, I'm Margaret Soden from Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been a community pharmacist in Fairbanks for over 50 years and recently retired from active practice, but I remain active in my association and kind of keeping in touch with my friends. And during this pandemic, pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, and the pharmacy students at ISU UAA really stepped up, and they took care of patients and efficiently got immunizations to Alaska residents all over the state. I can't be more proud of them. I think that's a wonderful thing that they have done. And I've seen many changes in my profession over my 50-plus years. When I took my licensing exam in California in 1965, my practical exam tested me on how neatly I could make powder papers. That expertise is a thing of the past, thank heavens. Medicines now have become so much more sophisticated, as well as the pharmacy practice itself has become more sophisticated, modern, and really there's so much more that goes into it than what I had when I was in my pharmacy training in the early 60s. Many changes need to be made to the current pharmacy regulations to recognize the advancements to the practice of pharmacy. Therefore, we need to empower the Board of Pharmacy to do just that. I really thank you for your service in the legislature during this kind of strange pandemic time and kind of locks us all down, and I urge you to support House Bill 145. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ms. Soden. Next up is Karen Miller from Fairbanks. Ms. Miller, please proceed.
Hi, my name is Karen Miller. I'm calling in from Fairbanks, calling in support for House Bill 145. I am a born and raised Fairbanks pharmacist. I'm very passionate about taking care of my Fairbanks community and the outlying areas. For the last 27 years, I've been a pharmacist here at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and their retail store at Denali Pharmacy, and currently hold the title of Director of Retail Services. I truly, truly want to thank you guys for hearing this legislation. I feel like pharmacists in my current practice, I help hospice, long-term care, and patients discharging out of the hospital. And a lot of times the pharmacist is in the background ensuring that the drug therapy is correct and is affordable for the patient. Meanwhile, we struggle as pharmacists getting correct reimbursement for our talents. And I truly believe that House Bill 145 will help us with this situation. Like Dirk, I'm on the run to another COVID vaccine clinic for today, and I just want to say thank you very much for hearing this, and if you have any questions, be happy to answer it. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Miller. Next up is Amy Tall from Anchorage.
Hi, good morning. My name is Dr. Amy Paul. I work as a clinical faculty pharmacist at Providence Family Medicine Center, and I support passage of House Bill 145. We are a patient-centered medical home and also the only family medicine residency in the state of Alaska. My practice includes 36 resident physicians and over 30 additional faculty and staff, and we serve over 10,000 Alaskans in the Anchorage area. Our number one resource to treat patients would be medications, and unfortunately, many medical school graduates only receive about a semester of pharmacology. As part of my practice, I'm afforded the opportunity to support physicians and patients through medication management and chronic disease state management. I work alongside physicians to help them choose the most appropriate medications. As an example, we had an 8-year-old Alaskan in clinic yesterday with otitis media, concerned for a ruptured tympanic membrane. I was able to lend my expertise in choosing an appropriate formulation for an eardrop that wouldn't increase the risk for worsening infection. I'm board certified in ambulatory care and advanced diabetes management, which allows me to lend additional expertise in the realm of diabetes care. As a clinical pharmacist, I'm able to meet with patients and educate them about their disease process, including lifestyle modifications and how they can use their medications most effectively and benefit them with the least side effects. As an example, I was able to meet with a woman last week who had a diagnosis of diabetes for over 20 years, was managed with an insulin pump until her insurance stopped covering it, and she had to switch back to insulin pens. She wasn't using mealtime insulin and didn't understand how to use it appropriately and was afraid her blood sugar would go too low. I was able to get her a continuous glucose monitor and a Bluetooth device to help manage her mealtime insulin. Also, she mentioned during that visit that she wanted to quit smoking, so I was able to counsel her and send in a prescription to help her with these efforts. I received a note from her yesterday stating, "Thank you so much for spending time with me to help understand diabetes and insulin management better. I had no idea my blood sugars were so high and that this could affect my heart, and you helped me understand how to manage my insulin better. I feel confident with your support that I'll be able to get my sugars under control and even quit smoking. I wish every clinic had a pharmacist like you." Utilizing clinical pharmacists to optimize patient care like this allows for providers to meet more patients for their acute needs, improves provider and patient satisfaction. Unfortunately, due to current regulatory limitations, many of these services are not reimbursed by insurance payers, making these services unsustainable in many primary care clinics and other practices. I thank you all for your support of House Bill 145 so that we may expand provision of clinical pharmacist services in a sustainable manner to improve health and well-being of all Alaskans.
Thank you. Next up is Susan Wheeler from Bethel. Ms. Wheeler, please proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Susan Wheeler. I'm a resident of Bethel. I'm a pharmacist at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. And as part of the tribal health system in Alaska, I feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity to be an integral part of our care team for our patients. The pharmacists here are already engaged in providing many of the services that would be impacted by the changes proposed in House Bill 145. Our pharmacists are fully integrated with the providers, nurses, and other healthcare professionals who provide care. However, due to the lack of our ability to enroll pharmacists as billing providers, we are unable to receive compensation for the services provided by our pharmacists. I would like to say thank you for recognizing how important the changes proposed in House Bill 145 are to our patients, our communities, and also to the profession of pharmacy. Pharmacists in most practice settings are the most readily available healthcare professionals, yet at the current time in Alaska, they are the only healthcare professional not listed in the provider anti-discrimination statute. This means that the most readily available healthcare professionals are compensated minimally, if at all, for providing the same services that would otherwise be covered if provided by a different healthcare professional. While our profession is dedicated to serving our patients and improving their overall health and well-being, the lack of compensation makes it difficult to sustain the ability to provide the uncompensated services that we are so well prepared and eager to provide. This makes the services we could provide less readily available to the patients which for some may be a deterrent, and prevent them from obtaining some of the basic medical services that pharmacists could quickly, easily, and competently provide. So this morning, I'm asking for your support of this important piece of legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Ms. Wheeler. Next up, Renee Robinson from Anchorage.
Good morning. My name is Renee Robinson. I'm an associate professor at UAA ISU College of Pharmacy, focusing primarily on pediatric pharmacotherapy and mixed methods research. I serve as president-elect for AKPHA and the AKPHA Immunization Task Force Chair, and I'm also the co-principal investigator on a Center for Disease Control and Department of Health and Social Services funded demonstration project aimed at supporting reimbursement for pharmacists providing health services to ensure and increase access to these services in rural and underserved Alaskan communities. I'm testifying this morning to voice my support of passage of House Bill 145. I've been fortunate to serve in a number of different roles in my 23-year career, the last 13 years in Alaska with my surveyor husband, who I met in Billingham, Alaska in 1997. I worked in the U.S. Public Health Service and also at South Central Foundation for almost 10 years, providing clinical care and conducting research with and for tribal communities. And for the last 3 years, working to train and better prepare pharmacy students, physician assistant students, and nurse practitioner students to meet the ever-changing healthcare needs of all Alaskans. What these unique opportunities have shown me is that together we can improve the health of Alaskans, leveraging student training experiences to improve and expand healthcare screenings, increase immunization acceptance, and support statewide vaccination documentation and advocacy efforts. The proposed House Bill 145 will resolve these long-standing regulatory issues that may impede continued progress while supporting necessary Board of Pharmacy oversight to ensure that pharmacists provide services are safe, that services impact on the community are captured, and that together we continue to support efforts to increase access to these vital preventative and health management services. Thank you so much for your time. And if you have any questions, please let me know.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Robinson. And Mr. Wadsworth was online for questions, not public testimony. No one else is online for public testimony. So with that, I'm going to close public testimony. We did not receive any amendments to this bill. Do members have questions of Representative Snyder or any of the experts online before we take action on this legislation? Okay, not seeing any. Is there a motion to move House Bill 145?
Co-Chair Fields, I make a motion to move HB 145 version 32-LS0720/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 145 passes from the Labor and Commerce Committee. We will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork before moving on to House Bill 149 on child care provider collective bargaining.
All right, the House Labor and Commerce Committee is back on the record. This is Co-Chair Sponholz. Back up a little bit here. Microphone is very hot today. All right. So this is the second hearing of HB 149, Child Care Provider Collective Bargaining. Co-Chair Fields, did you want to make any comments?
Sure. Just to Zach Fields, House District 20, just to summarize for my colleagues, what House Bill 149 would do is provide child care providers with the choice of voting on whether to form a union, which would include both business owners and their employees, which would then negotiate with the state on wages and benefits for child care providers. If there was a yes vote on forming that union, membership would actually be optional. So it's sort of a right to work model. No one would be required to join it. But those who did participate would have wages and benefits set basically through a sectoral model, with the goal being to raise wages and benefits, reduce turnover, and provide a structure under which providers could have access to more affordable and better health care and to more widely available and structured training, which is what's happened in the 11 other states that are pursuing this model. So I appreciate the committee hearing this idea. I know it's a new idea in Alaska, and wanted to be available for any questions. And then following that, we do have a testifier, Christina Ohana Eubanks, a provider in my district, longtime child care provider, to offer her perspective.
All right. Are there any questions for Representative Fields? Representative McCarty.
Through the chair, I'd like to hear from the testifier and then ask a question, if that's good.
All right. Any other questions for Rep. Fields? All right. With that, we will go to invited testimony. We've got Christina Eubanks. Ms. Eubanks, are you online?
Hi, thank you very much. So my name is Christina Eubanks. I'm from Anchorage, and I'm here representing myself. I've been an early educator or early childhood educator provider in Alaska for the past 14 years, and have spent my career in the management of early childhood and youth development programs in Anchorage. The reality of poor wages and benefits for this workforce detrimentally impacts our working families. A healthy early learning system requires a variety of providers, both home and center-based, that are well-trained and compensated. I believe that HB 149 before you is an avenue to begin to address this issue. While Alaska is a beautiful state with amazing opportunities, our youngest residents experience alarming rates of adverse childhood experiences. A high-quality early learning system works to support children and families in building resiliency that prevents and counters the negative impacts of ACEs. The foundation of a high-quality system is a well-trained and fairly compensated workforce. Unfortunately, Alaska's system does not provide for livable wages to keep a trained workforce. Early childhood educators are among the lowest-paid professionals in the state. While the cost of child care is high, often comparable to a monthly mortgage or rent payment, the income does not cover overhead and the livable wage for the provider. This leads to high rates of turnover in providers, which is alarming because consistency in caregiving during a child's formative years is essential to provide a secure foundation from the child to grow from. The financial investment in early childhood saves the state money in education and health costs in the long term. Through the relationship with their caregivers, both at home and at childcare, young children learn if they can trust the people around them, if they are capable of doing things for themselves, and if they are good or bad. To best do this, caregivers need to have the skills to be attuned to each child's needs. Poverty causes stress, and when the majority of early childhood educators live in poverty, they are not best able to respond to the needs of the little ones in their care. When families lose their childcare providers, it causes immense stress. There is a shortage of providers in the state, so options for families become about available openings and not about a correct fit. This leads to a host of stressful outcomes that cause more stress on the family, child, and provider. The program I run has historically been blessed with incredibly low turnover rates, especially among my lead teachers, which are the equivalent of a home provider. COVID caused me to lose 2/3 of them, in addition to having a number of classmates turnover. It has increased the stress load on all involved as new relationships between families and teachers, teachers and children, teachers to teachers, and children to children are being forged. Life naturally has stressful moments, but it was buffered that the buffers that for a child is the safety of consistent caregiving relationships. We need to do everything we can to minimize the stress that the caregiving relationship is causing the child and family, which takes resources. The pandemic has caused the closure of many home-based providers. Now is the time for the legislature to act to keep child care businesses open and attract new ones. We need to be doing everything in our power to incentivize providers, but to continue providing care for working families, allowing independent child care businesses owners to the option to collectively negotiate with the state to raise reimbursement rates provides a way to increase wages and keep programs open. I urge your support of this bill. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Eubanks? Representative McCarty?
Thank you, to the Chair. It's not a question for Ms. Eubanks, but just to follow up, I just want to hear her testimony and then ask a question about this bill. Is that
after
this time? Okay, yep. Thank you. So I want to start with the premise here, and then with the question is, like, are children, and to have a child is an honor, a blessing, and a responsibility. And it definitely, you know, we understand this as Alaskans, it takes a village to raise a child. The parents, the families, the people in the village to do that, and support systems that could be child care in this form or child care in a family, you know, grandparent or whatever, maybe aunt and uncle. As I look at this, the question comes up as we're setting, and you said it so well, Representative Field, is that this is like a new paradigm consideration. But it's setting, and the question is it setting precedent to look at an industry, a private practice industry, and lumping them in as state employees to do collective bargaining. And that means that every single industry in Alaska could claim the same thing too. And that's of great concern. One of the things I see with parents in the consideration, and I did this for my kids, is that we had wonderful child care providers, but it reached a point where that one of the parents, their full salary is going to paying for child care, and it saw, okay, it's better that one of us stays home than under the illusion that we are making money. And I see that paradigm today. It still exists. I would like to hear your thoughts regarding that, the piece of setting the precedent that every business in Alaska is going to go to the state and say, what about me? I want to be recognized as a state employee, too.
Right.
All right.
Thanks, Representative McCarty. So the bill doesn't actually make them state employees, and it clarifies they're not public employees. It does allow a bargaining structure similar to public employees, but they're definitely not public employees, and language in the bill also says that nothing in the bill changes the employee-employer relationship. So, for example, if Ms. Eubanks wanted to be part of this collective bargaining structure, she would remain the boss of her employees. So I think the way to think about it is this is a sectoral bargaining framework. The child care sector, can we have better outcomes for workers, for business owners, for working parents whose kids go to child care providers by negotiating as a sector? This will not be a model that other sectors of the economy use, because other sectors of the economy are under the purview of the National Labor Relations Act. So it's sort of a matter of historical accident, although not really accident. There's some racist history there about the exclusion of domestic and farm workers from our foundational labor laws, which were passed back during the 1930s, when basically Dixiecrats excluded farm workers and domestic workers from these foundational labor relations laws. So the fact that they were excluded now gives us space to create a new model, while most other industries are and will remain under the purview of the National Labor Relations Act and would have no legal space to establish a new collective bargaining structure with the state. And all these other industries that are under the NLRA, they will continue to bargain under the framework of that law, which is a firm-based model for establishing labor relations.
You have a follow-up?
I do have a follow-up. I just question what you said. It's like, in the work of Cesar Chavez, did he not override what happened in the 1930s to acknowledge those individuals you mentioned?
Great question. Yes, and the interesting thing about what Cesar Chavez did is that he actually employed all this consumer pressure to force recognition of his union. So it was, even that was actually outside the purview of a traditional, hey, I've got cards, I've got 30. The way it works in a normal environment is you've got a firm and you have employees. If at least 30% of employees sign union cards and file for election, then they can have an election. That election is overseen by the National Labor Relations Board. You can also have what's called voluntary recognition. So, for example, farm workers, historically excluded from these rights, do have the ability to petition an employer for voluntary recognition, and they can employ public pressure to do that. And Cesar Chavez was brilliant at that. And employers decided that the economic losses for boycotts were so great that they would prefer to sign agreements with the United Farm Workers. They also signed agreements with the Teamsters. But he figured out a way to make the system work despite those historic exclusions in a different way than is contemplated under this bill.
Good last follow-up to the chair. So the child care providers are privately owned businesses. If they did something of this collective bargaining piece, that the parents that are bringing their children to those facilities, if they say this costs too much for us to go to such a facility, does this bill make it that somebody else is going to have to subsidize their losses, or they're operating basically under a capitalistic concept of, you know, supply and demand?
That is a great question, Representative McCarty. With the passage of the American Rescue Plan, the state of Alaska will be receiving, according to the Department of Health and Social Services, $76 million more every year than we currently receive in CCBDG, Community Development Block Grants for child care. And this is why the negotiation with the state is so central to this bill. We're going to get a lot of additional resources as a state to support child care, and I think we have a choice. Do we subsidize within the framework of an existing system where we are in a low-wage trap, a low-wage, low-benefit trap, or do we try to expand supply while raising wages at the same time, using these federal resources so that we can reduce turnover, improve working conditions for workers, and critically not raise prices on parents? And it's only because of that infusion of federal money that we have such an opportunity. Now, I think the other issue here is because this is an opt-in model, each employer is going to make a choice of whether or not to participate. And they may decide, look, under the structure that the state ultimately establishes for this ARP money, we don't think it pencils out to participate in this sectoral bargaining framework, and they don't have to. But I think the evidence from these other states shows that it is a win-win when you can have a larger pool for healthcare, a larger pool for training programs, and reduce your turnover with higher wages and benefits. So I think there will be an incentive to opt in, but it's not coercive.
Any more questions?
Yes, just the last one here. Thank you. So this brings up that if this industry has that funding stream of subsidized, it sets precedent for all business to say, I want a part of that pie. And it's really concerning that restaurants, especially what's happened with COVID on businesses, they're going to say, I have a right to a piece of that pie.
Yes, Representative McCarty, I think whether or not we pass this bill, subsidies for child care will continue to exist. And I think the question is, how do we best structure them to meet the needs of parents and employers? You know, child care subsidies exist now. I think, unfortunately, they exist within a broken system. The amount of subsidies will be expanded by virtue of a decision Congress made. So I think that decision has been made. And then our question is how to design the system best. You know, one industry I think about in relationship to this bill is the construction industry, where for a long time we have heavily managed wages, benefits, and how that industry works. We have prevailing wages for public construction. We have robustly funded state and federal capital budgets. I mean, we heavily intervene in that industry, and we've basically made a policy choice that if you're going to work in construction, you're going to be able to support your family. And to some extent, that's an arbitrary decision. You could say, why have we made that decision for construction but not child care? Aren't they both important? And I guess my view would be, where resources are available, we should always strive to provide conditions under which people can earn a living wage and employers can thrive within resource constraints. But guess what? We have more resources now, so we can change the paradigm for child care. But I do think that we actually intervene in almost every other industry in the state of Alaska already, and the question is how.
And I'll just point out as well that we don't subsidize, the hospitality industry in the same way, with the exception of providing Medicaid coverage to workers that are low-wage workers. And child care providers are amongst the lowest-wage workers in the state of Alaska. You can actually make more money working at Starbucks than you can providing care for children, which I would argue is a heck of a lot more important than making people's lattes. And it's really problematic. And so I think this is a sort of a novel approach. We're not going to move it today, but, it's a novel approach, and I think it's an interesting conversation to have. What are the different ways that we can look at restructuring what, Representative Fields accurately describes as a broken system that essentially is, it's very costly for individual, Alaskan parents, as you've said. I mean, I remember there was a time when basically my entire paycheck was going to childcare because I had several children, and that's really a problem, and it's resulted in women not participating in the workforce as much because of the gender pay gap. It makes it difficult when you have to make a decision about who's going to stay home. You're always going to pick the person that makes less money to stay home, which then damages women's ability to make income and realize their full, professional earning potential, moving forward. It's a structurally, broken system in terms of the economics, and we need to look at innovative solutions. And whether this is the solution, I'm not clear about that. But I think that, we need to be having those conversations about how to restructure this, because it is such a broken system that is basically, compensating a largely female workforce and also disproportionately people of color with low wages for doing what is one of the most important things that we can do, which is providing, early learning and safe childcare for our most precious resource, which is our children.
If I could follow up on Representative McCarty's question, great questions. I'm really glad you're asking them. I think it's also worth looking around the world at how do other industrialized, developed countries deal with child care. There's not an industrialized country on earth that doesn't spend a really significant amount of money on early care and learning. In a lot of countries, they more directly subsidize it at a higher level in a way that I think is not tenable in our context without significantly higher levels of taxation. That's a policy choice they've made. That's not the route that we're going down with this bill. I think, looking at the low wage trap, look, we could establish a prevailing wage for childcare and mandate it on employers and force them to figure it out with parents. I think that is a more coercive approach and one where it's going to be harder to figure out what is that right prevailing wage, where the subsidies play in, and it remains affordable for parents without putting providers out of business. So, looking at the range of options from just much higher subsidies, potentially public provision of early care and learning, which would also be expensive. It would work, but it would be much more expensive. I basically picked the most affordable and least coercive model that I could find among the range of options. But looking at other developed countries, they all invest, and it's for the reason that Co-Chair Sponholz cited. Kids' brains are developing the fastest at this stage, and if we're going to develop our human capital, we need to give them the best environment to do that, because we know that we have the highest returns on investment in education for these young kids before they even enter public school.
All right, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. So I'm picturing all these trillions of dollars that we're printing. I know the influx of federal money is an attractive building block for programs, but the total cost of this, if we unionize child care workers, that's not going to result in lower costs. It'll result in higher costs, as you're explaining. And those costs are going to be borne, at least temporarily, by this influx of federal money. So we will structure ourselves around something that is temporary by necessity. This money printing, the destruction of the dollar, is not going to lead to anything good. And I'm really concerned with that at a macro, very high macro level. If I'm concerned that we often look to federal money as the solution for our problems. And I guess, can you explain how this will reduce the total cost of child care, or a better delivery value of child care? I think the ultimate value of child care rests with if a mother can raise the child and be with them as much as possible. That's what I had, and it was great. I'm thinking my mom, because she took me to work with her every day. She got a job where she could take me to work. So I've been working since I was about 4 years old.
is Miss Eubanks online still?
Miss Eubanks is online.
I might turn to Miss Eubanks and see if she could address this question of how does having a livable wage with benefits positively impact an employer like her?
Did you hear the question?
Thank you for that question. I think it is that I have some really skilled staff that are meant to do this work. They're incredibly engaging with the children, present with them, and they're younger, in their 20s, and they don't see this as a career option because it doesn't pay a livable wage. There are no benefits. The joke is you have to marry well if you want to do this, because there is no retirement, there is no medical care. And so it does require, and it is a balance between, you know, wanting to raise wages right now in the field they're accepting, and then knowing that you're losing out, you know, if you make too much, then you'll lose Medicaid, or your children will lose Denali KidCare, because you can't afford to do both. And so we don't live in a society anymore where families, you do have stay-at-home parents. Often it is parents working two, if not, you know, both parents working, and sometimes more than one job each. And so being present with children and making sure that we're raising a generation of, you know, kids that are feeling loved and cared for and have good stories to tell and memories of their early childhood is essential. And given the way that things are going, we've been subsidizing child care for low-income workers for decades, and that's not going to change. It is exactly, we have more funds, and it's how can we best utilize them so that we can get the best benefit for all the people of our state.
Thanks, Ms. Eubanks. I guess the only thing I would add, Representative Kaufman, to try to answer your question is that, you know, every year we make an investment in the capital budget, and you could argue Congress could withdraw that. So I think when we have permanently authorized funding, as we do with CCBDG, it is rational to plan around that. Congress can, you know, maybe a future Congress repeals that. I think it's going to be wildly unpopular to do that. I think it's highly unlikely. But if they did that, then frankly, the sectoral bargaining structure in this bill would give the flexibility to providers and the state to adapt to those new circumstances.
Representative Fields, is it possible also that I think that the THRED and the Alaska Association for the Education of early education of children have all, you know, advocated, you know, education and continuing education. Is that also something that could be negotiated for as part of this?
Yes, and it is. And in some of these other states, you have, because you have a pool of employers working together, you can stand up more robust training programs.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. I think the core question is you can strengthen systems, you can strengthen multiple systems. The system of the family raising the child and the child having as much time with parents, mother, father, etc., as possible. That's strengthened through different processes than the process of strengthening a collective status type approach that attempts to build a state structure or federal structure for that matter that takes care of what is perhaps much better being delivered by the parents. And so there's a core philosophical question here of are we doing things to strengthen the parents' engagement in raising their children, or are we strengthening the status approach to raising children? Thank you.
Thanks. I think the decision has effectively been made, you know, with 40 years of stagnant wages for the middle class. As Ms. Eubanks said, it's a necessity now for most parents to both work, and sort of economic conditions, I think, drive that and result in almost all working families relying on child care. And, you know, I'm for everyone having the choice to the extent that economic conditions permit, but unfortunately they just don't for a lot of families. And if that's the case, then I think we all have to wrestle with what's the best system of child care to develop that human capital.
Thank you. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think if we could, and this is going outside our state, but there's a lesson for our state, if we could repatriate the industries that helped build this country, we have transferred so much wealth, so much commerce overseas, and I think that that's a big reason for the erosion in wages and the erosion in lifestyle of the ability to build a better life, a better future. And I think that in Alaska, if we were to do what we can do to help build our economy with in-state, a robust in-state economy, that there's the wages that affords all the things that we're looking for in this. And I think, you know, kind of the nuclear health of the family will go along with those better jobs, better opportunities. Thank you.
Well,
if I could follow up on that.
Briefly.
Totally agree. I think when you look at the countries that do continue to manufacture things and have these high-wage jobs in a global market, they're actually the very same countries that have the strongest early care and learning programs and the strongest career and technical education programs, whether it's Germany or your Scandinavian countries. And they all invest in early care and learning because that's how you get human capital to a point that you can have highly productive workers who are competitive in a global environment. But I totally agree, we have to make things.
I would also argue that there are a lot of reasons why people choose to work outside the home, and that it's a decision that should be made by the family, not by policymakers, and that we need to find a way to support the structure that allows people to make choices for themselves that best suit their own families. We also want to make sure moving forward that we start to work to remediate some of the structural systems that were set up in a different time that unfairly compensate some people at much lower values. I certainly respect the prevailing wage provisions of, you know, that are available in construction, but I don't think that caring for our children is any less important. And I think that, you know, finding ways to solve that problem is very important so that every family can make the choice for themselves that works for them, and also that makes sure that, you know, people that are doing critical work can live with dignity and not basically have to be on public assistance in order to, you know, to care for our most precious natural resource, which is, in fact, our children. So thank you very much for this hearing. We're going to take a brief at ease, and I'll hand the gavel back to my co-chair.
Back on the record, appreciate everyone really giving a lot of thought to that bill and look forward to further discussion. Next up, we have House Bill 125. And if the bill sponsor, Representative Nelson, wants to make his way to the podium, we can have a hearing on this bill. Thanks, Representative Nelson and Ms. Skipper. Again, this is House Bill 125, Military and Family Employment Preference. First hearing the bill in Labor and Commerce. Thanks to Representative Nelson and staff for presenting.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields and Co-Chair Sponholz and the rest of the Labor and Commerce Committee for hearing my bill. For the record, my name is David Nelson, representative for House District 15 in Anchorage. House Bill 125 seeks to extend current private sector and state unemployment hiring preferences to military spouses and dependent children. Military spouses are among the highest unemployed and underemployed group. They are highly educated and qualified for a range of careers, but because of frequent moves, the unemployment rate among military spouses is 24%, and there is a 26% wage gap compared to civilian counterparts. In 2019, the Blue Star Families Military Family Lifestyle Survey found that 49% of military spouses indicated that financial issues were the top stressor for military families, and 48% were concerned about employment. Of employed military spouses, 75% were considered underemployed, and House Bill 125 can provide some help to reduce these concerns for military families by providing a hiring preference. A COVID-19 military support initiative created by the Blue Star Families and the Association of Defense Communities found that an additional 17% of military spouses lost their job during the pandemic, on top of the 24% unemployment before the pandemic. Currently, 35 states and the District of Columbia provide hiring preferences to active-duty spouses or surviving spouses. House Bill 125 will add Alaska to this growing list of states that support our military community and honor the sacrifices these families made. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak on House Bill 125, and I will answer any questions the committee has.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Skipper. Would you like to do this actual analysis at this time?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, my name is Kim Skipper, staff to Representative David Nelson, House District 15. Section 1, this section does not prohibit a private employer from having hiring preferences for persons described in Section 2 of this bill. Section 2, put my glasses on here. I'm afraid they're going to fog up. Section 2, this section repeals and reenacts the current statute by adding definitions removed from Section 1 for clarity. This section does not prohibit a private employer from having a hiring preference to active military, veterans, and families. This section adds language to include spouses and dependent children of deceased service members to the list. Section 3, this section amends the State Personnel Act to reference definitions as stated in Section 4 for consistency. Section 4, this section amends the employment preference for veterans or former prisoners of war by adding a new language to include families of active duty service member, veteran, or former prisoner of war. This section also clarifies the type of preference given the hiring process and whether the applicant is disabled or not. Subsection B is removed for consistency. Section 5, this section clarifies that a person may receive an employment preference under only one of the categories described in Sections 3 and 4, and a person may use the preference without limitation when being considered for a position for which a person who are not currently state employees are being considered. If the recruitment for a position is limited to state employees' preference under A or C, this section may not be counted. And the section also adds language to include spouses or dependent children for consistency with other sections. Section 6, this section clarifies that this bill does not involve interpreting amendments of a collective bargaining agreement and makes a reference to subsection A of Section 4. Section 7, this section defines a dependent child. And Section 8, the section removes language that has been included in Section 4 of this bill. And that sums up the sectional.
Thanks, Ms. Skipper. How about we do invited testimony and then open it up for questions from all. Tammy Perot from the Department of Defense, would you like to proceed with your testimony?
Coach Fairfield and Co-Chair Sponholz, thank you very much for the opportunity to provide testimony today. My name is Tammy Perot, and I am here representing the Department of Defense and Military Families. Thank you for this opportunity to support HB 125, expanding protection of private sector employment preference and establishing state employment preference to spouses, dependents, and surviving spouses. As part of the Northwest Regional Liaison Office for the Defense State Liaison Office, operating under the direction of the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, our mission is to be a resource to state policymakers as they work to address quality of life issues for military families like this important issue. This is our area of expertise. In February 2020, in a letter to Governor Dunleavy, the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness highlighted the need to support military spouses. The letter stated that military spouse employment and the associated financial and personal well-being is an important component to the retention of service members. More than half of all active duty military personnel are married, and 88% of employed military spouses indicate they wanted or needed to work. Not only are military spouses highly influential in general regarding their service members' decision to remain in the military, but over 28% of service members reported that their decision to leave the military would largely or moderately be affected by their spouse's career prospects, end quote. Alaska is home to approximately 8,000 active duty military spouses and over 3,200 National Guard and Reserve spouses, making them an important part of the workforce. And as you have heard from the sponsor, military spouses are among the highest unemployed and underemployed group in the nation. Additionally, spouses report significant challenges obtaining employment due to frequent moves, creating additional stress on their family finances. As such, the Department of Defense supports the policy within HB 125 and asks that this committee move this legislation forward. We are especially appreciative to Representative Nelson for the introduction of this bill and those who have joined him as additional sponsors. I stand for your questions.
Thanks, Ms. Perot. Do members have questions for Ms. Perot, the bill sponsor, or also online for questions, Pam Day, Deputy Director, Department of Administration, Personnel and Labor Relations, Dan Wayne, Ledge Legal, and Verdi Bowen, Director of the Office of Veterans Affairs for the State of Alaska. Representative Shockey.
Yeah, thank you through the chair to the bill sponsor. So very happy to be a co-sponsor of this bill. I think there's certainly a demonstrated need for some additional employment preferences for military spouses. I did not hear, however, a lot of justification for the inclusion of dependents. And I'm just wondering, I didn't hear from either the invited testimony or your sponsor statement. Could you speak to the need for that and why the decision was made to include dependents in this bill?
Certainly. And thank you, Representative Shragi. And through the chair, Representative Shragi, the reason why there's dependents on here is necessarily if a military individual is on a deployment or is away from home, they might necessarily be single or they might be a single military member. And thus, we don't want it to fall underneath the dependent who might be over 18 or under 18 to lose out on that benefit. If they're struggling, say, an E2 or an E3, that's only making, say, $35,000 a year, and they're deployed, that individual, that the dependent that's still left in back at home in Alaska, they still have to go out and find work and find employment, and they will still be underneath that underemployment or unemployed compared to military spouses.
Thank you for the response, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit offline at a later time.
I think Representative Snyder has a question.
Thank you. Following that line of inquiry, Representative Nelson, do you have, I appreciate you sharing the number of other states in D.C. that have similar hiring preferences. How many other states do include the dependents component?
If you look at the back, there should be an NCSL section that will provide you some information.
Okay. Mm-hmm. For clarification, I want to make sure I'm looking at the right
document.
Which document is it? Is it this one
here?
Does this one contain information specific to dependents?
No. Specifically to dependents, no, it does not. But that's just what the NCSL put out. Just specifically on the staff.
So at this point, it's unclear of the 35 states plus DC. Which one of those would has the dependents
correct
component?
And Ms. Perot, do you know the answer to that question?
Through the chair, thank you very much for this question. This is a great question for the National Council of State Legislatures. I do not have that specific answer as far as what states include dependents versus what states do not, but we can definitely assist with that research.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, thank you. Representative Spahnholz.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important question. I absolutely support sort of the underlying intention of the bill. I, you know, personally have hired military spouses that if you'd looked just at their, you know, resume, they might not have looked like as a competitive compared to other candidates and found had really amazing, you know, results. I had hired a volunteer coordinator who was a military spouse when I worked at the Salvation Army, and she had been working as a volunteer coordinator because of, you know, deployments and young children and, you know, moving frequently. She was one of the best employees I've ever had, and she continues to work at the Salvation Army and is, even after, you know, new base assignments, has transferred within the Salvation Army because she was such an amazing employee. I'm a little bit confused as to the unclear about the necessity of the dependent element. Nobody makes a lot of money when they're a young person, and I don't think a lot of people think much of, you know, people moving or having short job tenure when they're young. My children are kind of in the age range that are sort of being referenced right now here, and so I think getting that information will be really important.
And to answer that, and through the chair, Representative Spahnholz, I totally understand, and maybe like Representative Shragi, we can talk offline about this, but this bill is also for those individuals that may be a Gold Star family, so I've lost that military member, and that stipulation on there will give them that extra little help for employment. So, you know, even though there's not a spouse right now, they're still a dependent and will fall under that category.
Representative McCarty and then Shragi.
Okay, thank you very much. Through the chair, Representative Nelson, like Representative Spahnholz, I've employed and still employ people from the military, spouses to former colonels. And does this bill make it that an employer has to consider individuals? And it's kind of puts them in a interesting situation in the consideration, or is it that if they have a preferential piece to that, they're just not going to be what's the word? I'll just say dinged for doing that type thing.
Through the chair, Representative McCarty. What this bill specifically is, for the private enterprise, for private industries, it's a may, not a shall. Just gives a recommendation. And then on the state side, all it does is ensure that they are getting at least a consideration, so an interview. It's not a guaranteed job to any of that effect.
And Dan Wayne, can you just confirm for Representative McCarty that we are not inadvertently requiring private employers to, quote unquote, consider an applicant? We're simply protecting them if they choose to prioritize veteran hire.
Yes, good morning. This is Dan Wayne. I'm with Legislative Legal. Section 2 of the bill, page 2, line 12 and 13. When hiring an employee, a private employer may grant an employment preference to the following, and then it lists out all the people that this bill is aimed at. So there's nothing in that section requiring them to provide that preference. It just allows them to.
And that's the only section of the bill that affects private employers hiring, is that correct?
Section 1 is part of the Human Rights Act. It says, you know, nothing in this chapter is intended to prohibit a private employer from granting an employment preference described in 2388.010, which is, you know, the veterans, service members, former POWs, spouses, dependent children, all of that that's covered elsewhere in the bill. So 188200, that subsection that's being amended in Section 1, that applies to the private sector. So it gives them protection from being, I think, as one person on the committee said, dinged for exercising that the preference that's established in this bill.
Thanks, Mr. Wayne. Does that answer your question, Representative Gordy?
Thank you very much.
Representative Shragi and then Snyder.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to, one, back up what Representative Sponholz mentioned. We've hired a number of military spouses through our business in Anchorage, and they've been some of our most successful employees and just have done a tremendous job. In fact, could not be happier. So certainly see the merit in, again, encouraging opportunities for employers to provide a preference for military spouses. I think that's a great thing. And I just wanted to note, I think the argument for Gold Star families is, I think, certainly a valid one, and maybe we'll offer an amendment to narrow the scope of the dependents that are eligible for an employee preference or an employment preference, but just wanted to get some of those thoughts on the record.
Representative Snyder.
Thank you. Yes, echoing my general support for this approach, but in the spirit of thinking holistically with the variety of legislation that we address in this committee and our other committees, I did just want to point out on page 43 of the, the Blue Star survey of military spouses, that one of the things that was also listed of importance and of need was increased access to childcare. And I know that's not directly relevant to this bill, but it is germane to our conversation on whole today, and wanted to just point that out.
Okay, thank you. If other members don't have questions, I wanted to ask Ms. Day to walk us through how, I know it's written out here in Section 4, but if you could walk us through how this would actually change the hiring process for the state, I would appreciate that.
Good morning. This is Pam Day with the Division of Personnel Labor Relations Administration. And through the chair, to answer the question, what this would just mean for us is we would look to update our application to add this additional preference, so that way a spouse or dependent can designate that they are a spouse or dependent of a military member, and then that means that we would be able to give them consideration, which means we would be reviewing their entire application in order to determine whether they should be, you know, selected, rejected, or considered further within the selection process.
Thank you. Additional question along those lines. Explain how that might be different for someone who's not in one of these sort of preferential categories. You said you're going to review their application. Are there people for whom you don't review an application, and what applications would you typically not review?
We review application packages first to determine if the applicant meets the minimum qualification for the actual job class they've applied. And then from there, then we apply. We will have various selection criteria, and that is where we will set predetermined selection criteria, looking maybe for specific experience, education for that particular position we're looking to fill. So this just means that if with this particular consideration preference, if they meet the minimum qualification, their application will even be reviewed further.
I see. And could you also talk about the opportunity to interview and how this bill changes what the current practice is?
Well, our current practice for veterans, regardless if they qualify as, you know, the disabled veteran or former prisoner of war, or if they are the veteran, our practice has been to offer an interview. And so by expanding this, our practice would be to also look to if they meet the minimum qualifications is to, our practice would be to then extend this to offer an interview as well.
Two spouses, thank you. How many people does the department typically interview for an opening? So you've got people who meet your minimum qualifications, that's a pool of people. And then how many people beyond that do you typically interview?
It really varies between, depending on the job class, depending on the amount of applicants we get for the particular job class.
How about a range?
It can range anywhere for, I would say, for a job that's maybe harder to fill, we're looking for more specialized education degree, it might be 3 to 4, but for a broader job class, such as trying to fill like an office assistant, administrative assistant, we can interview up to 10 to 20 applicants, maybe more.
And in terms of the current preference or the current requirement to interview veterans, how often does that actually result in someone being given an interview?
Well, right now, if we are our practice is to interview a veteran, so they are granted an interview.
And what I'm asking is, how often are you actually interviewing veterans? In other words, how many veterans are actually applying for state service and being interviewed? And is it possible to comment on how much difference the statute has actually made in practice?
I do not have, I don't have that information. I can look to see if we can get that information, but I do not have that information today.
Okay. Do other, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I'm not sure who can best answer this, but I'm wondering, across the nation of the states that have enacted similar legislation, have there been any conflicts with other hiring preference legislation? Are there any potential conflicts or gaps or busts or just that matchup of other legislative preferences versus the imposition of this one? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I can punt it over to Tammy Perot. If she does not know, then we can connect offline and I can get you that information.
Ms. Perot, do you have thoughts on that? Do these preferences conflict with any other preferences in your experience?
Thank you very much for this, for repeating the question through the chair. That is a great question, and that do these conflict? And from the Department of Defense's perspective, we have not seen these conflicts. Again, I would want to clarify that through NCSL as well, to just ensure that no other states have seen this conflict.
Thanks, Ms. Perot. Dan Wayne, are you aware of any statutory conflicts or conflicts in terms of hiring preference where the department or an employer is going to be balancing kind of two mandates?
This is Dan Wayne, and I am not aware of any legal conflicts presented by this bill.
Okay. I have another question for Ms. Day if other members don't have questions. Ms. Day, do we know how many military spouses currently work for the state? I'm guessing that's not something we track, but I'm curious if we do.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have two that work for me. So, yes, we do.
Beyond your immediate office, is that something we track?
They are two of the best hires we've made as well. So,
is that something we track more systematically throughout state government or not, the hire military spouses?
No, we don't. We don't track that currently.
Okay. Well, seeing no other questions, does the bill sponsor wish to add anything before we adjourn this hearing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, thank you to the Labor and Commerce Committee for hearing this for the first time. It has a meaningful impact, not just to me, but to the soldiers that I represent, soldiers and airmen, and to all their spouses and dependents. This is a critical issue, not just for the state, but also for the DOD and what they see. It's very important, and I urge your consideration on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. So we'll hold this bill. The amendment deadline is Wednesday, April 21st at 5 p.m. The last item of business today is to forward one of the governor's appointees. The House Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee as shown below and recommends that the name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Dave Tallarico, Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation. Thank you again to Lee and Marissa, our secretary and moderator. Our next Labor and Commerce Committee meeting is Monday, April 19th at 3:15 p.m. and at 9:45, House Labor and Commerce is adjourned.